Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I am delighted to be able to be talking to Jenny Zhang today. She was born in Shanghai and grew up in New York. She's the author of the poetry collection Dear Jenny, We Are All Fine, and the story collection Sour Heart. And her latest poetry collection is called My Baby First Birthday. Jenny, it's so nice to see you.
Hey, thank you for having me. This is cool.
We were just talking about how the world is wild right now.
It's chaotic.
It's chaotic.
And it's reckoning with pretty much all the human mistakes that we've made since existence started.
Just a few, huh?
The moral is you can't get away with it forever. You just can't.
It catches up to you.
In the most micro and macro way, yeah.
And which is a great segue into talking about your latest collection, where so much of the premise is based on, we never asked to be born. We were born without consent.
Yes. Yeah. I was very concerned with that as a child. I was very concerned with that as a teenager. And I guess I'm still very concerned with that. For all the reasons of why the world is having a reckoning right now, because it always troubled me that the first thing that happens to us is that, as you said, we're born without consent, without getting to choose. And then we're born into a world that is not safe, is not fair, is not loving to all. And depending on who you're born to and where you're born to and what you're born into, your safety might be so severe, your lack of safety might be so severe that you don't even get to live very long, or the life you live is not worth living, or it's too painful. And so those are things that I thought about a lot, obviously as a teen, because life for all teens,
yes,
even the incredibly privileged ones, often feel too unbearable to keep going. And it certainly did for me. But I think at the same time, I was also grappling with, and I honestly think we're having this right now in America and all across the world, I was also grappling with the fact that, like, well, I already was born and I already lived this life. And in some ways, like, I don't ever want to not live this life. This is the most beautiful life that could ever be. And I'm so grateful that I got to be alive. I'm so grateful that I had people who kept me alive, who nurtured me, whether it's my blood family or chosen family or strangers. All the things that make human life ecstatic and worthwhile, I think, have to do with connection. Yes. And all the things that make human life terrible and not worthwhile and painful have to do with the lack of connection, the severing of connection, brutality, all of the things that are the opposite. So, yeah, I think this book grapples with that duality a lot.
And you mentioned the theme of loneliness quite a bit. And I just was thinking, like, could you have imagined that, you know, we're in quarantine month 3.5? And it's a nice reminder that loneliness is part of the deal.
Yeah. I know. It's interesting because when my book was coming out, I think there was a whole thing, as you know, in February and March, writers whose books were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really tough time for those writers, especially the ones who this was their first book, or they'd written it for so long. I mean, that's every writer. That's not just some. It's every writer. It's a terrible experience to not be able. It's a personal tragedy that is made to feel pretty small in light of, like, a mass human tragedy.
Yes.
But at the same time, like, personal tragedies still matter. Like, people's parents still die. People's loved ones pass, not related to COVID, not related to the protests. People lose and relationships. People have big dreams that they were waiting to debut that didn't get to happen. So I think that was happening, and I was really feeling for those writers. But then my book sort of was a little bit after that. My Baby First Birthday came out, I think May 12th or something like that. And by then, the publishing world had sort of figured out a way to promote books.
Yeah.
But I think I myself was like, who cares? Who cares about my book? I don't care about my book. I can't even imagine caring about my own book. So I couldn't ask anyone to care. And I had gone through this whole internal struggle of like, why should someone spend... I think I was very much of the mindset of like, these are end times and I don't want anyone to do anything in end times that they don't want to do. Like, if you're not going to live the life that you want to live now, dude, it's going to be too late. Like, do it now or you'll never do it. And so I really felt like, why should anyone spend their time reading my book? And I did have to get over my own apathy to myself and what I had written, and in a way, like, find meaning again, and try to believe that I'd written something that wasn't only relevant in non-pandemic times and non-unprecedented times, because actually everything is unprecedented in a different way. And actually the themes are always the same. Loneliness is loneliness before and after pandemic. They take on different forms and you reach different depths, but it's still, I mean, I was lonely before I had to be lonely for a public health crisis.
Right.
People who get married were lonely before they were married and can be lonely after they get married. Like, all kinds of things exist regardless of changed material circumstances, even if changed material circumstances make a huge difference. So I think that was something that was interesting. And also the fact that a lot of the things I was writing, I was kind of projecting into the future. I was writing about the ways in which we were destroying the planet and the ways in which wealth was being worshipped in a way that felt evil to me and antithetical to human connection. And it seemed like we were barreling towards an apocalypse. And it also seemed... And then I was also really concerned with, I don't know, there were these concerns I ended up having that I think, I hope, are actually relevant now still. I mean, I don't hope they're relevant because I want them to be irrelevant.
Right, right.
I think they are relevant, sadly.
I one of the things that really got to me about the collection, and of course I would never, you know, tweet this, but... The wanting and needing of attention is something that doesn't actually go away just because there are 1,000 million things worse in the world.
Yes.
And so for that, I really did sympathize with the writers who would like get their little bit of attention for their books. That's the payoff.
Totally. And also, if you're writing a book, I mean, not everyone does this, but I think if you're like a deep writer, you're writing about like human joy and human misery. These are eternal themes that have the same obstacles keep coming up with different faces and details. Mm-hmm. But like, you should be writing about things that are kind of like present in human life until we figure out how to unfuck up everything, and then we live in like a utopia.
Okay.
And then there's no reason for books, I guess.
Well, they'll all be happy.
Yeah. Exactly.
Jenny, switching topics a little bit. This collection features many different bodily fluids. Goo is one of the best words that's used quite often and can mean just about anything. Why do you think people get so uncomfortable talking about the things that happen to everyone in everyone's body?
It's a good question. I don't know. Because I guess my inverted question is like, why am I comfortable with that? Like I did not have any reason to be, and I was never taught that it was okay to talk explicitly about the body. And I was often chastised for being too explicit about the body, because I don't think we live in a society that is welcoming. I don't think we live in a society that likes bodies, to be honest.
No.
I think
unless it's a very certain body.
Exactly. Unless it's a very certain body that has punished itself and hurt itself a lot to look that way and cannot look that way for very long. So that's also a form of hatred, because to put those bodies on pedestals, the very white, very thin, you know, very toned bodies or whatever that is, bodies of deprivation for a woman, and bodies of bulk for a man. That's like that is also a way of hating a body, because the amount that you have to go through to achieve perfection, it's killer.
It really is. It is.
And it's also killer to, like, look at how much we hate bodies. Like, we're reckoning with, like, how much, like, this, the institutions that are supposed to protect all bodies are, like, actively targeting, harming, and killing Black bodies. Like, I don't know, like, actively neglecting Indigenous bodies, actively, like, just hurting, like, trans bodies. Like, I don't know. So there's a lot of, I think I'm, like, disgusted by the disgust of bodies in this,
like,
in this culture. And I think, to me, every act of intimacy I've ever had, whether it's a friend or it's a lover or it's a family member, has involved, like, loving their body and my body. I don't necessarily mean in a sexual way.
Yeah.
But, like, I want to know about what ails my friend's bodies. I like seeing, I'm not disgusted if they have bad skin, if they have whatever is considered bad, if they're sick. Like, I want to love them through it all, and I want to be loved through it all. So it just made sense in these poems to go there, because, like, everything happens in the body. If you have a conversation with someone, your mind might not know if they're a safe person or a dangerous person, but your body knows. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Your body, yes, tenses if they're not safe. Your stomach hurts if they're not safe. You feel closed. And I think so many people are so disconnected from their bodies. They think that they can figure it out through just their brains alone. And it just doesn't work like that.
And especially when you're talking about the ecstasy of connecting with with other people, or the, yes, loneliness of, like, those are things that you feel in your body.
Yes, totally. And birth, like, totally destroys for in a very intense period of time and stretches to the limit a person's body. And then you have to put yourself back together. I don't know if you're a mom or...
I am not, but I mean, this is another good segue. One of your other big words in this book is cunt.
Yes.
And not just your cunt or other people's cunts, but your mother's cunt.
Yeah.
Tell me about using that word that so many people, yeah, again, find icky.
Yeah. I'll never really know if I'm doing justice or doing something interesting. I can't say that, to be honest, because there is also an overemphasis of an obsession with genitals and all that stuff. But I think, why do I use that word? I think because this is a really good question. I haven't talked about this in a long time. I've only just done it. I think you know, I'm going to tell like a sort of parallel story that maybe will illuminate this. When I was a kid, I grew up in this very, I went to a school that like didn't really have white people for the first 8 years of my life. And like it was to the point, and I was a very naive kid, but it was to the point where there was this kid from Ohio who moved in my sixth grade. It's like the first white kid I'd seen in 5 years. And he was like, we all made fun of him and like really abused him for his white skin. So I had it all twisted. I was like, wow, like I feel so bad for white people. Like everyone's racist against them. Like I literally didn't get that it was the exact opposite because of the way I grew up. And so there was this white kid, a different white kid, who's not in my grade, but a different grade. I actually don't even know where he came from. But every day I would walk to school with my grandfather, and this kid would come up to us and he'd walk with us like part of the way. And I, in my naive little brain, was like, oh, this kid like thinks we're the best. Like he can't stop hanging out with us. Like he just like loves us. He's always around us. And, but I could feel like in my body, to go back to bodies, that something was really off, that maybe I was wrong, because the way he was talking to us was kind of aggressive at times. Mm-hmm. And then later I moved to like a white suburb, and I kind of, sorry about the sirens,
the way we live now,
I kind of realized that the word chink was a slur, and I hadn't known that before. It, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you watch a Disney movie and then you watch it again 3 years later and it's like a whole new story because mm-hmm. you knew all these words now and you realize that you missed half the story. But it was like, I realized I missed half the story. I realized that what he was saying was word chink over and over to us, to me and my grandfather. And I realized in that moment what I thought it was not what it was. And it was so weird that all it took was me learning the definition of that word and how it was used, because if I hadn't, I would have never known or something. And I took that kind of naive approach in some ways to the word cunt. Where I was like, why can't it be sweet and nurturing and cute? It sounds funny. Yeah. And at the same time, I also, you know, when this terrible human being who is in office right now, I can't like say his name, when he got elected in 2016, I love that you're just shaking your head like that, not say his name. When he got elected, or before he got elected, and he was talking about grabbing women by their pussies, it was this thing of like, I was never allowed to use that word pussy in any publication. And suddenly the New York Times is printing it, no asterisks, no. And I'm like, why is it that we're only allowed to say things when they're used to violate someone? Why is it when I use it to celebrate or to make fun or to be funny or to be glib or to be anything else, it doesn't count until someone is saying it to hurt people? And now we have to share that. And it's like, we're seeing this now in the news. It's like, why didn't we care about the way that we were treating Black people in this country until the worst thing keeps happening and we'll only talk about it then? Yeah. So I was like, let me freaking change that to the best I can and make this word like have every valence of meaning possible. So it can't just be a word of violation, at least in the universe of my book.
Right? Yes.
I think I answered your question.
I think you, that's amazing. One more word I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
Seppuku.
Oh, yes.
Jenny, tell me, it's another one of those words where I feel like I have a very standard definition of this word and the idea of this word, and then you kind of changed my mind in the course of the book.
Well, I also use that word in a way very irresponsibly, and it's totally, if anyone wants to call me out on that, they're totally in the right, because I'm not Japanese and I don't really have any authority to talk about like a deep, like ancient you know, like story, like a practice of ritual suicide that, I'm not a scholar and I'm not Japanese, but I was playing with a couple of things. I think one thing I was playing with are these like very traditionally masculine ideas of honor, and that one way to restore one's honor when the world has become truly too dishonorable and too evil is to commit ritual suicide in a very showy and performative way. And I was writing these poems at the same time. I mean, this is really dark, that there were all these men committing mass murder suicides. And it felt ritualistic.
Yeah.
But like in a way that made me so angry of like, it boiled down to these men who felt like they deserved to be fucked by the hottest women they wanted to be fucked by. And so they had to go down in this blaze of glory, and like their pain had to include other people feeling pain, that they wanted people to feel their pain.
And that so, no one else's pain was relevant or.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. It sickened me and it upset me. And it's like, yeah, the only way their pain would have been resolved is if women just agreed to be like assaulted by them or something. I'm like, I don't want to do that. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the ways in which, you know, I think of myself as Chinese or Chinese American, but I've had to identify myself as Asian American. And that includes like so many different countries, so many different cultures. Countries and cultures and people who've hated each other, who've oppressed each other, who've murdered each other, who've genocided each other. My grandmother still can't watch a TV show where there's a Japanese soldier on TV without convulsing, because she saw Japanese soldiers quite literally slicing pregnant women's bellies open and pulling fetuses out and twisting their heads off. Like, she can never forget that. And for me, I don't feel any animosity when I see a Japanese person. In fact, I'm like, oh, we're comrades because we're all, you know, racialized as the same person in America. So I was also playing with this idea of like ignorance and like not like flattening those extreme nuances that only the people who know them care about. And then the last thing I was playing with is just, I mean, I do it, I guess, throughout the book, but like taking extremely serious, deep things and talking about them glibly.
Yes.
I don't know why I did that. I guess I just wanted to, because I also just felt like, why is it, like, if it's just true, for example, that all women, you know, cis and trans women are truly like violated by patriarchy, if that means all of us have been in some way violated, then it's like I still want to have fun. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm still a fun person.
Oh, even that's such a good part. That's a good message for these times, truly.
So I think that's where the glibness comes in. Yeah.
I am going to ask you in a second for some book recommendations, but I did want to shout out a line from, I'm looking, page 3. I have all my, oh, your whole body is slanted.
Mm.
And you say, when did I agree to be a textbook for you and your whole dumb family? And I can't stop thinking about that when I see anti-racist reading lists.
Yeah. Right. Totally.
And if perhaps people were reading not only to educate themselves, but to broaden their worlds.
Totally. Totally. I think, I don't know if it's in that poem or another poem where I think I write something like, admit you want me to have a function. Mm-hmm. It comes from that same feeling of like, don't just be interested in me because the world and all of its media is saying that we've harmed this group of people so badly, and you belong to the group of people who's complicit in harming this other group of people. Be interested in me. Be interested in everything before then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a person, always be interested in knowing more about people who don't get to have fun because they're dealing with harm. Always be interested in why you get to have fun. Is it because you're not dealing with harm? And if you do that before the worst has happened, then you won't, like, it's like all that Twitter stuff of like check in on your Black friends, and then it's like, but don't just like check in on them. They don't like want to hear from you if they don't know you, and you're just asking them like, oh God, are you in? I can't even imagine what you're going through. It's like the reason why, like, I don't know. I laugh at that because it's like, because the I think the moral is like, just actually be a friend. Like if you're an actual friend and you're always checking in on your friend, even when there aren't national,
that's what you do with friends.
Exactly. And you know how to check in on your friends. Some friends don't want you to be like, how can I help? Some friends want to be like, hey, I want to come over and not talk about any of this stuff. Because I think about it all the time, and I want to freaking listen to Mariah Carey and gossip about people I don't like with you. And that's how you're my friend. So it's like, get to know people on a human level so that you're not reducing them to their traumas. Because nobody freaking wants that.
No one wants that. Tell me what you've been reading lately.
Ooh, okay. Well, I've been returning to poets that really give me solace. I haven't been able to read new things, to be totally honest. I think because I'm just looking to feel homey. So I've been reading my friends. I've been reading Tommy Pico's poems, his tetralogy, IRL Nature Poem, Junk and Feed. I've been reading Morgan Parker, Magical Negro, and she wrote this really cool YA book called Who Put This Song On that I'm really loving. I've been reading Yi-Young Lee. Her work is really dark. Her essays are really dark. If I wrote all about birth, she's been writing all about death. And it's been soothing to me for some reason. I don't find it dark. I find it soothing. So I've been reading Dear Friend, From My Life, I Write to You in Your Life, and When Reasons End, or Where Reasons End. Yeah. And then I've been reading Danez Smith's new poetry collection, Homey, which I think is so good and so delicious. And yeah, those are the books I keep returning to over and over again. They just make me feel warm.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I had the best time going off on all these things. Thank you for letting me do so.
Please, anytime. Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.